I'm sorry I wasn't with you last week, but I had a previous engagement with the flu. So we'll try to go on now without further interruptions in our programs as long as possible. We have a very interesting subject this morning, and one about which there is very little common agreement on teachings and beliefs. The most exhaustive and contemplative approach to the mystery of love was that of the Neoplatonists of Alexandria. From Neoplatonism, which in turn was a descent from the Platonic philosophy of Plato, from this system has emerged a mysticism that has been distributed throughout the entire world. Alexandria, which was the seat of Neoplatonism in North Africa, was one of the great centers along the caravan routes, and merchants, travelers, priests, monks traveled along these roads for centuries, resulting in an interchange of ideas as well as commodities. In the course of time, the Neoplatonists developed what might be termed a philosophy relating to the mystery of love. They realized, as time went on, that there had to be a deep and mysterious source for the idealism of the human race. There is something within each person that reaches out for affection and to bestow it. This power resides not in the mind, nor in the body, but in what we have tentatively termed the soul. The soul is therefore the source of the good within ourselves, and it is also part of the wonder that we have received from our divine inheritance. The power to love, the need to be loved, have descended from the most remote times. There is no period in which this system of interchange has not been noted and recorded. So the question arises, first of all, what is love? And this is the big question. Love seemingly is not part of any of the academic elements of the personality. Love is part of the principle which produces life. Life in itself is a manifestation of love. And love, therefore, is that which perpetuates, which binds together, which ennobles and deifies all of the other conducts of the human being. Love becomes, so to say, the leader of the purposes of life. And in our present time, we are in the presence of a great need for this, because it is only when motions towards culture, civilizations, education, politics, economics, and industry are seated in a love principle. Until that time, we are going to have continual struggle, strife, and conflict in the world. Love is the basis of an integrity. Love is something that ennobles conduct. It lifts our deeds, thoughts, and emotions from the commonplace and gives them a domicile within our own overlives, what Emerson calls the oversoul. Therefore, where there is love, there will not be deceit. Where there is deceit, whatever emotions exist that we call love are not genuine. All of the nobler instincts of the individual impel him to integrity. And integrity is the basis of honorable relationships between all living things. Where integrity fails, all else is at hazard. Integrity, therefore, is something that is sort of tied in with the Ten Commandments. It is part of the Sermon on the Mount. It is found in the dialogues of Plato and in the mystic writings of Buddha. Lao Tzu, the great Chinese sage, was a mystic, and all mystics are involved in the love mystery. Love mysteries which transcend all denominations, sectarianisms, and things of this nature. As Paul says, love suffereth long and is kind. Well, I think if we look around us today, we'll find that people who suffer long are not kind. And that instead of the individual placing his integrities in the foreground, he shortchanges his entire life by discarding them. And where he is unhappy, he makes the world understand it by making them unhappy also. Wars, problems, crime, deceits, exploitation are all part of an underworld against which antiquity established a code of moral integrities. These integrities were for two reasons. First, because the creating power demanded them, and second, because mutual existence required them. So the ancient, most primary form of love, as listed in Neoplatonism, is love of God. Now, this is itself a very intangible thing because we know very little about what God is. So that the effort to love deity, while it is found in all the religious writings of the world, is very difficult to interpret. We know also that many different nations have had various attitudes towards deity. Some have used the principle of God to justify war and plunder. Others have used it for exploitation. Others have used it as the basis of the building of theological empires of wealth and power. Actually, however, the love of God was, according to the ancients, the primary basis of our relationship with the universe. Whether we consider deity as a person, a principle, or an idea, that which holds the universe together is this basic concept of essential goodness at the source of existence. Lord Bacon says that he would rather accept all the fables of the Koran than to assume that the universal fabric was without a mind. So there is an over-mind, an over-spirit, an over-soul, an over-consciousness, an over-reality, which more or less seems to be necessary to explain the common things of existence. Without an understanding of some superior principle, the inferior objects of our attention are comparatively meaningless. Now, the ancients in the beginnings began to worship God in terms of what they believed deity expected of them. Deity expected them to live in harmony with the Sermon on the Mount, with the Ten Commandments, or their equivalents. In other words, worship was keeping faith with reality. The worshiper had to practice what he believed, or it was not worship. Prayer was originally a hymn of glory or praise to the unknown for the privilege of existing in a universe of values that helped all of us to improve and give us securities. So in the beginning, the idea was to worship God by keeping his commandments. If you love God, keep his commandments. Now, the loving of God became one thing and the keeping of the commandments became something else. The love of God seemed fine as long as it dealt with intangibles. But when it got down into the marketplace, it was very difficult to keep the commandments. Each individual with his own private ambitions, his own private exploiting instincts, decided to build the world closer to his heart's desire, which largely resulted in exploitation. But the principle behind the beginning of love was that the human being, created out of the divine reality, whatever it may be, pays homage to its own source, is grateful for the privilege of an existence, is ever mindful of the wonders of life around him, and as he contemplated the mysteries of the world, the sciences, the arts, all of the different divisions of human handicraft, it became increasingly evident to the average person that there was a sovereignty somewhere greater than himself, and that this sovereignty was his protector, and that without it his own efforts, trials, and obligations were meaningless. So gradually deity became the principle of an ideal, an idealism which has survived through all different religions under various names. So the Neoplatonists said love of God comes first. Love and respect, veneration for the total of which we are a part. We cannot look out upon the mysteries of the universe, the cosmos, space, time, and eternity, without some realization that we are in the presence of an awesome reality, something tremendous, something incredible, something far beyond our ability to understand, let alone to define or organize in thinking. So worship became a bowing to that which is better, a humbling in the presence of true greatness, a power by which the individual realized that he existed, that without this power he could never have been. And then, of course, comes the question as why he came to be. And it became evident to many ancient peoples that his existence was due to the love of God, and that in his turn he protected himself by loving the God who was his creator. Also, we have to realize that the ancients, living largely on the level of the brood family or the tribe, saw in deity the ultimate patriarch, saw in the deity the elder of elders, that which came first, and recognized this patriarch as a benevolent pattern, a benevolent significance, not necessarily a person as represented in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, but an over-reality. It became obvious that this over-reality had to be intelligent, or it couldn't have fashioned the world. It had to have a reason, or it would not have done so. It had laws by which it administered its own creations, and it was probable and appropriate that man should also abide by these rules. So gradually the parental figure appeared, the magnificent over-being, in which we all live and move and have our being, and for which we must have a proper attitude. Somewhere in the early times also, the individual found that there could be certain inconsistencies between himself and this divine being. He found that he intentionally or unintentionally broke faith with this divine being. And when he did this, something went wrong. He found, for example, that when he broke the rules began to break him. He suddenly discovered that this power, this mighty power that ruled all things, was also an absolute authority, that it had within itself the eternal possibility of rewarding virtue and bringing vice around ultimately to redemption. So in the beginning, at least, moral codes arose, such as the Code of Hammurabi and the Justinian Code later. These codes were efforts on the part of human beings to codify the experiences of God's will. These codes all were based upon experience. They proved conclusively that evil got into trouble, that injustice was punished, that false beliefs died and many, many people died with them. Everywhere, evil was in some way penalized. Selfishness was penalized. Arrogance, the enslavement of human beings, this was penalized. Anything that was not beautiful and not good could not be according to the will of God. So over a period of thousands of years, a kind of deification came into existence. I think it was Voltaire who pointed out that the first and most important concept of God was that he was a highly glorified Louis XV. Well, he could have been to a certain degree, but he certainly didn't have the faults and failings we attribute to Louis. Actually, however, man trying to find an image for this power had nothing to copy except the realities of his own environment. So as he had his own chief, his own prince, his own ruler, he thereby believed that the ultimate prince and ruler was this power of eternal realities. And all in all, he gradually and definitely came to the conclusion that he had to bestow upon this power all virtues. For if he did not do this, if he did not presume this power to be just, reasonable, affectionate, understanding, then all of his own personal relationships with life were threatened. If this deity could become angry, then there was a reason why man could be angry. If this being or deity became very vengeful, then there was reason for man to become revengeful. This was gradually written into theology, until a great number of destructive attitudes were sanctioned because they were attributed to the will of deity. Of course, the deity had nothing to say about this, but the human being got himself into all kinds of troubles by believing that his deity had the same weaknesses that he suffered from himself. So all in all, we came finally to the conclusion in the world in general that this deity was good, that this deity was concerned, involved, and many different philosophies were developed to explain these involvements. Whether the deity was indwelling in the human being, whether there was a separate existence in space, or whether space was simply the body of this deity, whether deity ruled from above or from within. And the mystics all finally came to the conclusion that God ruled from within, and that no one could look out far enough into space to find this deity. It might be there, but we could never find him. But the deity within ourselves is approachable. And as it approaches us, it gives us the codes of law. It sets upon us rules. It strengthens us with conscience. It does all kinds of things to try to make us live right. Sometimes we resent it. Very often we deny it. But if we expect to survive, we must obey it. So this became the basis, more or less, of our entire attitude of the love toward the love of God. God was the infinite goodness, worthy of our veneration, our respect, our adulation, and our acceptance. So the ancients, including the early Semitic tribes, Christianity, the Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, all these different peoples, all agreed that the greatest of all virtue was to love God as the source of truth, as the source of reality, and as the hope of glory. So this foundation has come down to us. It has survived in many mystical institutions and has been perpetuated by generations of mystics in all parts of the world. So the first thing that we say and the kinds of love, is the love of God. Now, the second kind of love, beyond of God, is part of the first. Actually, all forms of love arise from the original first love, the relationship between man and the infinite. All other relationships are secondary. But in their secondary relationships, there is a concatenation. Some are more immediate, some are more important than others in the general pattern of things. But all are subject to the same overrules. The Neoplatonists, Platonists, and many others decided that the second proper point where man could direct his attentions and affections would be in his love of wisdom. Now, wisdom was something that was considered in two different ways. There was a wisdom within God, which God alone knew. But there was a search for wisdom among human beings, desperately striving to find out what God wanted, to find some way of proving their religion by glorifying their Creator. Wisdom, therefore, became the search for the proof of the reality of God. Love of wisdom meant simply that the individual had believed that there was a great spiritual value in a form of knowledge or wisdom by means of which he could come closer to the discovery of the infinite. Wisdom was very different from learning. The older peoples thought of wisdom largely in terms of the elders, the patriarchs. The wise were those who had lived long. The wise were those who had traveled in far places. The wise were those in whose hearts and minds the love of humanity and the love of God were identical. So the search for wisdom led to the building of schools of philosophy and theology, both more or less interrelated in the beginning, by means of which it would be possible for the individual, through the love of wisdom, to acquire wisdom, and by acquiring wisdom, become closer to the deity, which he could not directly and immediately approach. So wisdom, the love of wisdom, was a great virtue to the ancients. Now, wisdom had all certain limitations upon it. All wisdom, to be wise, had to include the primary concept of the divine power. Wisdom was not an effort to build a Tower of Babel in the abyss, nor was wisdom to create a glorified humanity in which certain savants or teachers or sophists, as they were called, had great credit and recognition, were respected and admired for their wisdom. All of this was trivia. When Plato thought the matter over, he realized here clearly that the course of wisdom was not to glorify the wise, but to share in their knowledge, to glorify that which was worthy of glorification. Wisdom was therefore the problem of building a solid foundation under an ideal. If honesty was right, there must be proof of it. If idealism had values that could be perpetuated and communicated generation after generation, they had to be sought for, and every truth that was discovered supported the eternal truth of deity. So wisdom had to be idealistic. Wisdom had to have as its primary purpose the justification of the divine plan. Now, of course, today we have many scoffers who do not believe there is any divine plan. But it is not obvious or not recorded that this attitude constituted essential wisdom. And the Neoplatonists, especially Plotinus and Amplicus, were devoted to the concept that wisdom resulted in the development of an apperceptive mysticism. The truly wise person had the inner experience of the fulfillment of the wisdom that he sought. In the quietude of his own inner life, he had the experience of divinity. For a moment, he found himself picked up into the empyrean and had the emotional, mystical, psychical experience of being in the presence of the deity. This deity he did not see physically. He did not see it even emotionally or mentally. But more than seeing it, he was it. He became part in it. He was actually absorbed in a state of consciousness infinitely superior to his normal condition. Under those conditions, the mystics found the consolation of wisdom. They found the fact that no one is wise, really, but the Father, who is also the fountain of all wisdom. And because it flows from his own nature, it is a virtue. And because it flows from his own nature, it bestows upon mankind the privilege and power to know more about him and all the things that are accomplished in his name. So the love of wisdom was considered to be superior to the love of any physical ambition. The love of wisdom was much more marvelous than the love of wealth. It was much more powerful than the love of war or statesmanship or sciences. A man might be a great physician, and as such would be quite acceptable. But to be a great physician, he must be wise. Because without wisdom, sciences are dead. Without wisdom and vision, arts are useless, and they are all reduced to a strange mediocrity, such as we are seeing today in a great many areas of life. So the second great love was the love of wisdom. A love which caused the individual to sacrifice other considerations for the sake of becoming wise, with the realization also that with wisdom inside of himself, he justified the divine purpose and gained a greater ability to cooperate consciously with the plan of which he was a part. So wisdom helped man to serve God as a useful and helpful servant. And this was the blessing of deity, that he blessed those who sought first wisdom, because if he sought wisdom and righteousness, all other things would be added unto him. So wisdom became a power fulfilling in itself the love of truth, the love of reality, the desire to understand truth. But wisdom involved a kind of contemplative acceptance of something superior. Wisdom required the contemplative realization of a life superior to our own. It ensouled the universe, which was no longer merely a body of atoms or beings or particles, but was a great living thing in itself. And the universe, as a great living thing, was also a great loving thing, because it was sustained after it was created by the eternal love of deity. So all these things God worked their way into the Neoplatonic philosophy and gave us a certain understanding of the way of life. Now the third love is a little harder to us to appreciate because of conditions of our time, but it is essentially as sound as any of the others. And that was love of country, love of patriotic relationships with the earth, with the land, with our neighbors. The pride of country, based upon the fact that all work together to preserve the honor of country. To love country meant to be honest. It meant to keep the rules. It meant to help the widows and the fatherless. It helped to protect the natural resources. It made every man his own leader in reformation and the brother of all others. It was the conservation of other forms of life. Everywhere, the country, the nation, the basis of the racial demarcations. These were units, like cities or towns, each one of which was a responsibility to its citizens. Therefore, love of God meant honest citizenship. It had to mean that man worshipped the truth he could not see by working with the truth that he could see, and that he had to maintain as far as he could the dignity of the community in order that if the Lord asked for that dignity, it was available. Any time the individual is false to his community, he is false to his world. And when this falsehood gets bad enough, we have war, rebellion, and sedition. So that the love of country meant that each person in it would be an honorable citizen by decision of his own will, and would work with all other citizens to make sure that the land in which he lived was at peace and all the proper rules and regulations of a well-ordered structure. That wherever the parts of a country are neglected, or the levels of society are arbitrarily divided, in a community of the rich and the poor, there cannot be a full acceptance of the divine purpose. Each individual must try in every way that he can to help those in his own world who are in need of help. It is one thing to bring gifts to the altar of God, but it is also important to bring food to the mouths of the hungry. Both are acts of worship, and both are evidences of love. So love of country meant to take care of it, keep it clean. It meant that the citizens should have a recognition that in their religious life they give thanks that they have been born in a land which they could make beautiful by their own dedications. And if this land is not made beautiful, if it's bordered in strife and all the discomforts of competition, then they have broken the truth of God. God demands intelligence and integrity. Where this is absent, all other forms of worship are relatively imperfect. To pray to God and then cheat your neighbor is a very great and dangerous sacrilege, where people do not even pay any attention to it anymore. It is now open season on anything you can get your hands on. The individual has no feeling that his religious life is directly in ratio to his relationship with those around him. He does not want to cheat the friend, but he will cheat the enemy or the stranger. But in the universe of God, there is no stranger and no essential enemy. Everything has to be solved by the keeping of the rules, as these rules were delivered in flame and fire from the crest of Sinai. They are the rules of human relationship. Wherever they are broken, man suffers. Therefore, the problem of patriotism rests upon the individual accepting as a responsibility the duty to take care of the land which belongs to his particular tribe and be respectful and considerate of the land belonging to all other tribes. No competition is permitted. Each fulfills his destiny by perfecting that which is within his own domain. So love of family, love of patriotism, or love of the clan, was actually part of religion, because it meant that every day the individual had to watch his own conduct in order to make sure that he did not deceive or defraud. Now, this problem comes rather close to us right now with all the uncertainties and the skullduggery that is going on in the world. We suddenly realize that in one way or another we have become not only atheistic, we have become actually criminal in our relationships with life. And this cannot be excused or condoned, because the individual by birth is not this way. He has to be conditioned by an environment composed of other malefactors. Now, in all the other times, we have another point that comes in, and that is what the ancients called the worship of light. Now, light was a very wonderful and strange thing. It was almost as impossible to understand, for them at least, as the mystery of God himself. But, of course, with our astronomy and so forth, we now have discovered the sources of night and day, eclipses and the like. But light itself is something else, as Newton realized. Light is a symbol. It is a symbol of universal insight and understanding. If light is one thing more than another, it is education. It is an education founded in truth. In the ancient times, education was not in the keeping of institutions as we know them now, but was in the hands of private tutors or in the keeping of the religious institutions. The individual's education was more idealistic than now, even though it might be considered less academic. I think up to very recent times, that the Japanese, as I mentioned before, had a very good point on this, because I went through the curriculum of the grammar school, or middle schools, high school, and the universities, to see how they laid out their education. The grammar school had reading, writing, and arithmetic, but on the books it was written ethics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. High school, ethics, geometry, and so forth. The university, ethics, industry of art, science, medicine, ethics, anatomy and physiology. Everything that was taught had as a basis ethics. So this was the supreme importance. Without ethics, education produced delinquency. Without ethics, it produced persons incapable of perpetuating the better part of the world in which they live. Therefore, the ancients and most of the more recent, wiser people have considered the light principle as worthy of love. We love truth. We love light. We love understanding and insight. It is by light that the flowers bloom and the meadows are green. It is by light the children's eyes brighten in the presence of understanding and insight. It is by light that ignorance is dispelled. But light is essential learning, worthy of our love, worthy of our respect, and maintained in the spirit and principle of the eternal power that is at the source of all things. Therefore, light is in reality a symbol of the protection of truth as it develops and unfolds in the world. It is that something that suddenly gives meaning to all the other situations of life. When the ideas we learn light up inside of ourselves, then we have a kind of illumination. It may not be a great spiritual revelation, But when light hits knowledge, it lightens it. It makes it available. It gives reason for it and gives the person who receives it a new respect for the things he is learning. He is discovering, as the ancients learned long ago, that all the things he is learning are part of the mystery of the reality in which he exists. And he must, in all instances, put his roots down in that reality. If he has that reality, he can learn anything with safety. Without that reality, even the multiplication table can prove fatal. Now, after this particular point, we come to the next one, love. And this is love of beauty. The ancients were very firm in their belief that beauty was a mysterious and intangible thing, that beauty became a moral issue. Beauty was morality, and that which is lacking in beauty is usually asymmetrical. Everything that is not true, everything that is not worthy, everything that outrages the laws of harmony, rhythm, color, all of the arts, that which desecrates the art is a form of atheism. It is something in which the individual tries to put some small individuality of his own before the laws governing art and beauty. The laws of music, the laws of painting, the laws of theater and of the dance, the laws, all the laws of the performing arts are all under very strict discipline. There's not only the discipline of the performing, there is the discipline of the selection of subject matter. The artist may be good, but if his subjects are poor, he has compromised his skills. If he uses his skill to compete with others in the striving to create a wealth or fortune or reputation for himself, then he is wrong. Love of beauty has nothing to do with profit. Love of beauty has something to do with fulfillment. It is the individual becoming more aware of the realities. And in this, I think the Oriental arts are especially fortunate. The average Oriental artist does not even bother to sign his name. And up to very recent times, great art was never signed. Also, the artist, a potter, a very famous Japanese potter, was once asked why he didn't sign his work. He said he didn't sign his work because if they didn't know it was his, by the work itself, he had failed, so he didn't want it signed. Actually, this meditative process of the Zen masters, in which all art began with the tremendous discipline in the internal regulation of conduct, and in meditation, the artist sat by the side of the road or by the side of a little pond somewhere and looked and watched. And as they tell you of Sesshu and several of the other great artists of Japan, he may sit there with a brush and a piece of paper — they didn't use silk or canvas — and a piece of paper and look at what he was dreaming about for 6 months without putting a line on the paper. Then in 5 minutes, with five strokes, he created a masterpiece. It had to go through his own consciousness. It had to be given a quickening in himself. He had to have the experience within himself of meaning, of reality, of significance, and with it also a moment of quiet prayer that the universe would bless the work. No Oriental artist would ever make a great painting without prayer, because it has to contain a realization of the divine purpose. And great art in the East is almost always a prayer dedicated to love of reality, to love of something beyond our own common daily experiences. So art becomes another worthy field of endeavor. Love of great art is a symbol of maturity. A love of an understanding of art is an enriching of the whole life. And I think in the West now we particularly need to think about this, because we have now a very decided dichotomy here. We have people who love God, but they have never owned a piece of art that's worth anything. They hardly ever maybe go to a gallery to see anything. They do not realize the importance of expression. They do not realize that art is something that helps them to fulfill themselves. The individual who meditates hour after hour but never creates anything himself is missing the point. So art is a way of expressing your love for realities, love of beauty, and the wonderful possibility of delineating in one way or another, through your own insight, the proportions, dimensions, and relationships of living things. So art is a form of worship. To love art is to be a mature person. To love good art is to be a more mature person. And to recognize the art of the great artist, the very universe itself, in its sublimity, is to really understand the place of beauty and worship it and venerate it and see it in as part of the love of life. So the love of beauty helps to mature us, helps to make us better people, helps also to give us outlets of various kinds for the creative instincts locked within ourselves. Thus we have the actual development of these forms of creative expression. The next form of love that the ancients venerated and considered to be very, very important was the love of skills. There was something to be said for a person who had a great skill. I've told you before the story of the man who asked Antonio Stradivarius why he made violins. And the Italian master said, "I make violins because God made Antonio to make violins." Now, if we had more people who build automobiles from the same motive, if we had a few motion picture producers that worked from that foundation, if our television programs were dedicated to something of this nature, we might have a very much easier life. And what more than that, we would have a rapid lowering of the crime rate. We haven't realized at all that our mistakes are problem in our lives. We do not understand these things. We keep on doing what we please, accepting whatever comes along and expecting that the infinite will ignore our mistakes. But not believing in the infinite makes that a little easier. But the mistakes still have a harvest of grief. So skills of all kinds are problems of dedication. Here we have this great story of the Dionysian artificers that went into Alexandria to help to build the great city of Alexander the Great, which Alexander, by the way, never saw. In the greats of architecture, these clans of builders were dedicated to religion. When they decided to build a great building, they first gathered to worship. Wherever they moved to become cathedral builders and set up villages for their workmen, the first building was the church. Also, these people the architects had no narrow bigotries. When someone wanted to build a church like Notre Dame or Chartres, artists were called from all over the world. They might be Mohammedans, they might be Chinese, Japanese, Greek, whatever it was. A little later, they might be either Protestant or Catholic. But whatever it was, when their villages, when they went to build those buildings, there was no creedal division. Also, they set up their own way of rulership. They had their own Holy Trinity, the three masters of the work. They had their own servants and workmen, all of whom were on an equal social level. It took 300 or 400 years to build some of these churches. So generation after generation of the same family lived in these artificial towns until the work was done. If someone was sick or died, the group took care of the widow and the fatherless.